Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Enterprise, BUS 100, Section 8 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 3, delivered on February 22, 2011. The title of this lecture is The Agency Dilemma.
Today, The Agency Dilemma. In the last lecture, which is the subject of a podcast, I talked about contracts. And I went through the four pillars of a contract. I distinguished between contracts that were bilateral and unilateral, contracts that were oral versus written. There is one that I did not cover in that lecture that is more appropriate for this lecture, one division of contracts. That division of contracts that I didn't mention last time, but is more, it becomes more useful here. So I put it in this lecture, and it's obviously not on that quiz on contracts. But the difference between contracts that are expressed and those that are implied. Now, I could get into more detail with the implied. There is implied in fact contract. There is implied by law contract. I'm not sure I need too much to get into that. Although at the near the towards the end of this lecture, I'll make a comment about implied by, in law contracts versus implied in fact. But know this: an expressed contract is a contract where you have heard or seen the contract. That's a kind of a simplified way of explaining it, but it works. An express contract, you know there's a contract because you heard the terms and conditions and you agreed to it, or you saw, in the case of an oral contract, or you saw the contract, or something that would rise to the level of a contract if it were to go to a court. Those would be expressed. But that is not the only kind of contract that can happen. There are contracts that are implied. You could even argue that one about the McDonald's, when I go to McDonald's to buy a cheeseburger, that's an implied contract. It's implied that we're going to have a contract. We're going to do something here. It's oral, but we never say, when I go in, let us now engage in a contract. We don't do that. When you go to, let me think, you decide that you are going to have your hair done at a fancy salon. Your stylist will be Rolf, who will take care of you. Now you're sitting there in that chair and Rolf comes up and says, "May I help you?" And you say, "Why, I'm sitting here, I guess, I don't know." And so he takes you back and he gives you a nice hairdo. I mean, it's seriously good. And he gives you a nice back rub too, and the whole nine yards, an espresso coffee, and he gives you his number, and he says, "Call me." And then he takes you up to the cash register, and the lady says, "That will be $325. And you say, "Wait, oh, I was just sitting in a chair in your salon. Why are you charging? I mean, Rolf took me back. He was very handsome, you know, and he does give a damn fine back rub. But why am I paying for this?" Well, you're paying for it because there was an implied contract. You were in there. That was enough to imply. May I help you? And all of that kind of stuff. There is an implied contract there. You can't get out of it because you said, I never said I wanted this, and this done. It was implied. So keep in mind that you can enter into contract without ever saying, I am entering into contract, without ever expressly acknowledging that there is a contract involved. Now, that will come into play in later in this lecture. The implied contracts that can arise as part of your life. But before that, we are going to talk about expressed contracts. Specifically, I could bring up the one about employment. You will one day step out of this place and into a good job. With your degree, you'll get a decent salary. Because you were my student, you will get an even better salary because they will recognize your superior education. And you will sign a contract. There will be a contract somewhere in that process. When they say, we're hiring you, and you say yes, they will formalize that in a contractual document that you will sign. That's an express contract. Here's the thing, though. You see, the contract expressed in this case is quite necessary because you, through that contract, will become an agent. An agent is a person, and remember what I told you about person. Person doesn't have to be a human being individual. A person can be something other than that. But an agent is a person who is charged under contract with maximizing an interest of another. Who is charged with maximizing an interest or interests, it could be a broader than just a single interest, of another person. The principal, and that's P-A-L, the principal, the person whose interest is to be maximized under contract with the agent, by the agent. Those are the two sides in these kinds of contracts. There will be an agent, and there will be a principal. The principal will contract with the agent. And under the terms of the contract, the agent will be charged with maximizing some interest or set of interests of the principal. Now, let's go on here. Normally and typically, who is responsible for the agent's performance under contract? Who is responsible, ultimately, for the agent's performance under contract? The principal or the agent? What say you? Who is responsible?
Principal.
Yes. It is the principal's duty under the contract to ensure the performance of the agent. Here is the agency dilemma. The agency dilemma. The agent has incentive to maximize his, and I use the word his here in quotation marks, his own interests instead of that of the agent, of the principal, instead of that of the principal. Always. Remember, I'm saying here, has the incentive. That does not mean that the agent will, but we cannot be blind. The agent has incentive to maximize his own interest instead of that of the principal. That's just the reality of it. The agent is a free-willed thing. It has incentive to do what's right for itself. The agent, as a corollary, the agent will do so to the extent possible given the monitoring and enforcement provisions of his contract with the principal. The agent will do so to the extent possible given the monitoring and enforcement provisions of his contract with the principal. Remember what I said, too. Monitoring and enforcement is the principal's job, not the agent. So, in other words, the monitoring and enforcement falls upon the principal, and therefore, the extent to which the agent extracts agency costs is the fault of the principal. Let me show you the hierarchy. Authority is the highest power. From authority derives responsibility. And from responsibility derives accountability. You have no accountability if you have no responsibility. You have no responsibility unless you have authority. Now they can try to push it on you. Well, you were responsible. Where was my authority? You're accountable. Where was my responsibility? Where was my authority? Don't do this to me. Well, we're giving you accountability because we care about you. I've been told that before. You know what my response is? Do not blow smoke up my ass and tell me you're having a barbecue in my honor behind me. Let me take this out of contract per se for just a minute here and tell you a story. I've seen some of you driving around here. You drive like blind trout. Okay, and I'm trying to see who has nearly killed me. Let me not do that. I don't want to embarrass anyone. Let's just take you, sir. You're driving along, and you've gotten yourself on one of these country roads, really smooth. It's a beautiful, clear day, straight road, nothing in your way. Miles and miles of beautiful asphalt. And you think to yourself, you know, there is so much distance between me, my gas pedal, and the floorboard. That's waste. You drive by a sign that says 45 miles an hour. Now, I know you people out here. You see 45? That's not a speed limit. That's a challenge. So, this little voice in the back of your head comes from the days of the original Star Trek. Scotty, warp 6. And the stars begin to slide in straight lines all around you. And, you know, you're getting up your speed there. Why shouldn't you? It's okay. Way up the road, you notice off on one of those spurs, those drive spurs into one of the fields, you see a car parked there. And as you get closer and closer, oh my God, it's a cop. Well, now I know that suddenly you will become a fine, upstanding young Christian stud. You will slow down monitoring. You will suddenly behave yourself. You know very well that's how we do it. And as you approach, you think, oh, okay, didn't catch, they probably wasn't in the radar beam. But as you get closer, you notice that the policeman is standing outside of his car. Oh God, he's got a radar gun out there. And then you realize, no, he's leaning over. Oh my God, that son of a bitch has a flat tire. He's fixing his flat tire. Now, are you going to drive by him at 45 miles an hour? No. You'll drive by him. You'll wave. It might be one finger, but you'll wave. Enforcement. Do you see how if you don't have monitoring, you got nothing? If there's no monitoring, there's nothing. And if there's no enforcement, there's nothing. First, they have to watch you, and they have to be able to do something about it. And it has to hurt enough for you to believe that the probability of damage is greater than the pleasure you are getting. That's monitoring and enforcement. That's a cruel way to think of it. That's a harsh way to think about it. But it is the reality of it, is that agents... And going back to agency now, that was a little outside of agency. But going back to agents, you don't assume intentions, you assume capabilities. Are they capable of doing something that is contrary to the interest of the principal? If they are, then we should monitor. But it's not just about monitoring, it's also about the enforcement. We can monitor all day long, but if the enforcement isn't there, who cares? You can have tough enforcement. But if there's no monitoring, then who cares then? It has to be both of them. But there's another side to it, too. There's another part to it, too. You see, agents can extract agency costs. And I will give you four of them here in just a minute. But suppose that it takes more effort, a higher cost of the surveillance, just the opportunity cost of time of the principals to watch you, then you can possibly save in agency costs. You won't do it. I'll give you a story, and I do have to be a little bit careful about how I describe this one, although it's long ago in my past. There was a consulting job I was doing, and they were, at that time, it was a meat packing facility. And it was a relatively small, it was a smaller operation, but it seemed to me it was pretty big and busy. They had a problem with theft of meat by those who were working there. This was grueling work. You know, you're wearing these smocks and you got these things on your hands and you're cutting up dead animal flesh all day and all that. It was grueling work. But they did know that they were having slippage. And jokes went around among the executives that there were women who would come to work and then when they left they'd be pregnant. Well, that was a roast that they had put under their coat on the way out. And guys would, I won't go to that one, but it had to do with stealing sausage. Now I wasn't directly involved in this, but they, at the time, they were actually getting bids for a camera system in the main cutting, on the main cutting floor, and then on the parking lot, and then in the principal door by which people left. And they found out this. They were losing, they estimated, maybe about, $1,000 a week in meat. They got the cost of this surveillance system, which was going to run about $25,000 for El Cheapo cameras. I thought, well, yeah, over 25 weeks, maybe we'll say. But then they also started adding up other costs, maintenance of the equipment, but even more so, they had to have people watching the monitors all the time to keep the people, you know, it wasn't going to do any good if they couldn't watch. And then they had to determine, they would have to build these policies up to deal with theft. What you did, is it just everyone, you're fired if you steal, or do we give you a warning? You had to create formal written policies to avoid lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. They realized that it wasn't going to be one of those things where monitoring and enforcement was the way to go. They realized, actually, the loss was less, from the theft of the meat was less than the cost of monitoring and enforcing. Essentially, then it became almost like a perk. And then one of the young executives, he came up with a really good idea. He said, why don't, instead of making it a crime for these people to steal, why don't we let them? We just say, look, we're going to set it up so that you can grab a little piece of meat. We'll have an hour where you can do some quick cuts. Don't get our prime meats, but you can get something at the end of every week on Friday before you leave. You can pick up a little bit for your food for your family. That was a much, much smarter solution in the end from what I heard. That pretty much eliminated the theft. You formalized it, you recognized it, you made it a perquisite of the job. Not a perquisite, I don't mean that. A benefit of the job. It was ingenious how they solved it. But the main thing was that they could not monitor and enforce at a cheap enough price. Go ahead. That's a good question. Think about it this way, though. Are you familiar with the financial concept of present value? Okay, you see, the value of money falls over time. I give you a choice. I'll give you $100 now or $100 in 5 years. Which would you rather have? You'd rather have the money now, because $100 in 5 years is not worth a whole lot to you now. So over a long period of time, you can save quite a bit of money. Yes, but what is the value of that now, which is when we are making the calculation? We're not making the calculation for a year from now, 10 years from now. We're making the calculation for now. And we might find ourselves, and they determined that they were in a position where, yeah, we might be able to save money over a long period of time in. But if you take the present value of that money that we're going to save 5 years from now, when everyone's got the message, is that really worth paying the money right now? In other words, if in finance we get into the concept of net present value of project, the costs in present value terms versus the cash flow in present value terms. From their calculus, and I can't tell you that they actually did it in such a formal way, they determined that whatever benefits were going to flow, the cost right now was going to be more than the benefits would be over a long period of time. There was also a concern, and I'll just mention this. There was also a concern that, I don't even know how to frame this right, but it seemed like the people had assumed that this was one of their things that they were allowed to. Oh, no one ever bothers us. It's okay. And to change the rules dramatically does have an impact on the workplace. Well, we've always said you couldn't do this. Now we're going to enforce it. That's asking for a disruption in the workflow, a demoralization possibly. They wanted it to be, they knew it was gruesome work. They knew it was. The owner of the place, he'd started it as a meat cutter himself. He knew it was terribly bullshit work. So I almost wonder, to the extent, did everyone have a silent agreement? Then they thought, well, we're no longer going to have the silent agreement. And then they finally came, let's make it an open agreement. Many companies, however, take the other route. They've let something go, and finally they crack down. That tends to have some pretty severe consequences sometimes. Let me mention those agency costs to you. There are four of them. The costs that an agent can extract come in four flavors. The first of those four flavors is direct theft. The one I gave you there, direct theft. The agent steals. That is extracting a cost from the principal. That's the principal's value. The agent is extracting it by directly taking something of value. Meat, pencils, paper clips, something like that. Money. One of my favorite examples I observed this. It's actually fairly well known. I don't know if it's so much anymore, but I was in it back in the day when those soft serve yogurt shops were really a hot thing in the 80s. I was in one in a very fancy community. It was in a strip mall in a fancy community. And I was just sitting there grazing, and there was this big rush of customers that came in right after church on a Sunday. And long line of people who were obviously of better means because they lived in this area of town, of a big city. And they were lining up. There were two people doing the orders. And then there was a younger woman who was taking the money. She was moving surprisingly slowly, and people were getting antsy. They were getting their soft serve, and it was melting. The kids were bouncing up and down. And so she was working her way through, and that'll be $11.35. And it was pretty predictable what the price would be based upon what people were ordering, and people were lining up. $11.35, someone give her a 20, and she'd slowly work it up on the cash register. But then if someone would come up and she'd say, oh, that's 15, she'd ring it up on the cash register. That's $11.35 or $12.50. And the person gave exact change. She'd set the change right on this lip of the cash register and say, next. Of course, everyone was glad for this because the person would get out of there, he'd give an exact change, the next person would get up to the line. And then every once in a while, this would happen. People would pay exact change. And if you watched very carefully, she was actually excellent at it. She just leaned forward, next, into the big pocket in the front of her apron. She would take the money that she had set up there on the cash register. She was canceling the order if they paid exact change and went between the customers. And the money was stacking up there for exact change orders, and every now and then she'd just lean next, and she'd push that money into the front of her skirt. It was brilliant. That's direct theft. Now, how can you stop that? You'd have to have a monitor, something watching her at every turn. Oh, yeah, let's search her when she leaves tonight. Really? You really want to take the risk that the money is still there and then have her sue the whoopee-doo out of you? Tough one. The second one is perquisites. Perquisites are benefits extracted from principal by nature of position. Perquisites. Benefits extracted by agent from principal by virtue of position. The CEO who has a desk that has a square area on top the size of an aircraft carrier, the padded leather seat. Not that many years ago, I was at a dinner with some executives of a company, and they were talking about going on their business trips, first class flights, and of course, high-end motels, five-star, four-star, and meals. They were talking about the meals at the great restaurants. They made the comment, you know, you should come to work for us. We were good friends. I said, no, you don't want me in your finance department. You know what? First and foremost, Greyhound goes to most cities. You can get your butt on a Greyhound instead of on a first-class flight. Moreover, most cities I know have a Motel 6. You do not need these fancy motels you're staying in. But we have to. It's our job. We have to put on. Don't give me that. And about those restaurants, Denny's is 24/7. You see, these men and one woman were extracting agency costs. The principals were the shareholders. And because these people were executives who had, by their position, the ability to have those nice things, they took them. They took from the shareholders. That's a perquisite. Sometimes we call them perks. And they are every bit as much theft as is direct theft. And what those executives were doing, and I don't care if they hear this, I don't give a damn, they were doing even worse than that lady who was scooping the money off the cash register. It was a lot more money that they were doing every time they went on their first class flights, stayed in their really nice hotels, and ate at restaurants where I wouldn't even know what to order because they don't have a burger. The third one, shirking. Avoiding necessary duties. Avoiding necessary duties. The famous water cooler employee hangs around the water cooler instead of going to his desk and working. That's one. Going outside, taking a smoke break every 20 minutes. That's another one. Other ones, playing solitaire at the computer in your office. Well, I don't have anything to do. Find something to do. That was one of the things that was brought up by one of the people who spoke at an FFMA meeting a while back. Don't ever, ever, when you're in a job, especially early in the job, don't ever say, I don't have anything to do. Get on your feet and start asking, what can I do? Who needs some help here? Always. But shirking can be even subtler. I love the story of was told to me by an account executive at one of the Alphabet houses. Alphabet houses are insurance brokerage houses. They set up insurance for big, big companies that need insurance coverage and all that. She told the story. She said, one of the executives, a producer, every morning he come in promptly, 8:30, grab the newspaper off the receptionist's table, desk, and head back and go to the men's toilet, where he would spend 45 minutes sitting there on the pot, taking a crap. He was more regular than any man I ever could have imagined, reading his newspaper for 45 minutes every day. Oh, I'm on the job. I'm just in the shitter. Yeah. And that is shirking. Every bit as much as going out there for that extra smoke break, every bit as much as just hanging around, talking to other people, every bit as much as playing solitaire. Don't do that anymore, for God's sake, because they monitor so well in these corporate environments. You probably don't want to do that. You certainly don't want to surf for porn anymore. But you see, that was the way it used to be. I mean, people, when computers were first out, people, wow, they're solitaire, Minesweeper. Can't do that so much anymore. But shirking is a big, big cost. You are taking money from the principals. The fourth one is kind of interesting. Incompetence. Incompetence. This is where I bring up a famous axiom of management. It is called the Peter Principle, after Dr. Peter, who was the first one who set this forth. People thought at the time he laid this out in the book, The Peter Principle, it was like, ha ha, that's a funny thing. He didn't mean it as a funny thing. In fact, it is a rule of management. The Peter Principle goes like this. You will rise in a corporation to your level of incompetence, and then you will stay there. You will rise to your level of incompetence, and then you will stay there. Think about it. You start in a good job. You are an excellent employee. Start at the lowest, you know, first rung level. So if there is a good meritocracy going on, you'll advance. They'll promote you. And now you are in a management position and you're doing really well there. Over a period of time, if they have any sense, they'll promote you some again. Now suppose that in this final, this job that you've just been promoted to, you can't do it. You're constantly handing off the work to your underlings. That's shirking. You're constantly just trying to quickly look something up on the internet because you don't know what they mean by calculate this. You're incompetent. Well, you're no longer demonstrating merit to rise. You'll stay where you are. So when you look at a corporate environment, and look across the rooms, the offices, you are seeing people everywhere in that place who are either on their way to or have arrived at their level of incompetence. That's how it works. They are either on their way to or they have arrived at their level of incompetence. Keep that in mind. That's the Peter principle. Now, incompetence in general. You will run into it when you are in the corporate environment. This is not a deliberate evil. This is not a conscious thing. If you can't do a job, okay, you've been in this company and you're really a hotshot. Okay, we'd like to, you know, you're making, let's say, $60,000. It's time for us to move you up. $110,000 a year, we're going to get you a company car, we're going to get you some perks, you're going to be able to fly around the world, do some business for us. You can't do this work. You know you can't. Are you going to say no? No, you probably aren't. Your incentive, your agency incentive is going to be to rise to that level of incompetence and then hope to God you can figure out what the hell you're supposed to do, which you probably will to some extent, but not to the extent necessary to fulfill your agency duty to its highest. Those are the four: direct theft, perquisites, shirking, and incompetence. Those are the four different ways that an agent can extract agency costs from the principal via as a result of the agency dilemma. Now, this sounds like an awfully grim view of the world. Well, yes, it is. But there is another story here. The term is used too much in the modern world, but it is there. I love erasing people's stuff that says "do not erase." Sorry, that's my whiteboard, not yours, Ace. Now, what if, by the nature of an agent and principal relationship, by the nature of the principal, he or she or it would have a permanent defect in ability to monitor and enforce? What would happen in a situation where the principal, whose job it is to monitor and enforce, that's the principal's part of this thing, cannot, and that cannot be fixed, that cannot be repaired, it is just there. Let's try a few different examples. By the way, I did want, before I go any further, I do want to throw out a couple of agent-principal relationships and see if you can identify the agent and the principal in them, okay? Oh, here's one that's kind of interesting. Parent and child. Who's the agent? Who's the principal?
Child is the agent.
Whose job is it to maximize the interest of the other?
Parent.
Yes. Well, that means the parent is the agent. The child is the principal. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? The parent is actually the agent in the child-parent relationship. The child is the principal. Let's try this one. In a marriage, I'll pick on you. Woman, in a marriage, who's the agent, who's the principal? No, you can't get by. Nope. You're dancing. That's a good tap dance.
The woman is the principal.
Yeah, well, that's the way it seems, but no. Now tell me the man is the principal. No. Wait a minute. Wait, what? Okay, here's what's going on. The marriage is the principal. The marriage. The husband and the wife are both the agents. Their job is to maximize the welfare of the marriage. The marriage is a person under the law. And it is the duty of the marriage. I'm sorry, it's the duty of the man and the woman to maximize the interest of the marriage. By contract, a marriage is a principle by contract. So I don't want to get into this here, but when you hear about this disagreement, well, marriage should be between one man and one woman. Gay marriage is a violation. Watch it, because you are defecting, you are creating defect in a very clear contract called marriage. If you want the two agents to maximize the welfare of the relationship, then it must be, in fact and in law, a real live marriage. Whether you want that or not, that's another matter. But be careful when you want to use, don't want to use the term marriage for something that you want to perform as a marriage. Now, let's try another one. Doctor and patient. I go to you. You're my doctor. Doctor, this is a bad thing. I don't want to talk about it out here in front of all these people, but no, never mind. Okay. Who's the agent? Who's the principal?
The doctor's principal?
No, the doctor's maximize. Your job is to maximize my welfare, my interest. My interest is to keep my ass alive, okay? That's your job to do that. So you are the principal, I am the agent. Attorney-client. The attorney is the principal, the client is, the attorney is the agent, the client is the principal. The job of the attorney is to jealously, maximally defend to the extent allowed under the rules of ethical rules and all and law and all that, the interests of the client. Now, in all of these agent, principal, well, let me try one more. This one, personal one. Are any of you in here prior service or soldiers? None of you? Okay, well, let me throw it to you anyway. Okay, a soldier. Is he the agent or is he the principal? And what is the other side in that? Go.
The agent.
Okay, the soldier's the agent.
The country's well-being.
The country's? Nope, not the country. Do you have one? Okay, this one's a little unfair. First thing I did when I was inducted, I swore an oath. Do you know what that oath was to defend?
Constitution.
Oh, the Constitution is the principle. The Constitution is the principle. Do you see what's happening in these relationships? First of all, the one thing that it's important to point out is that I have given you some examples here where the principal isn't a human being. The principal is a legal construct. Marriage, a principle. The Constitution, a principle. These are things that don't even live and breathe. How can they possibly be responsible for monitoring and enforcing? They don't exist as living, sentient objects. Think about the parent and the child. The parent is the agent, the child's the principal, but how is a child supposed to monitor and enforce the parent's performance? in a doctor-patient relationship? How am I supposed to monitor and enforce the doctor's performance? Oh, if I die, oh, damn, you screwed up. I'd like to have a little bit more before something before that, you understand. The attorney and the client relationship, I don't know law. I'm the principal, but I am not trained in law to the extent that he is. I am not even allowed to practice law without a license. I'm allowed to participate in my defense. And if I choose to go the insane route of defending myself, yeah, I can. But it's the lawyer, the agent, who knows more about the law than I do. How can I monitor and enforce his performance? How can I know if he's right or wrong in his choice of defense? How can I know if the doctor, my agent, is right or wrong in his prescribed therapy? Especially, have any of you ever been in surgery where they knocked you out? Have you? Yeah. What are you supposed to do? How can you monitor and enforce when you're on another planet being happy? You can't, you see. What I'm trying to bring up here is this. There are some relationships, agency relationships, that are special. They are rare. You will see them in your lives. And in your business life, you could see one too. The board of directors, the executive officers of a corporation, are agents of the shareholders. Their job is to maximize the value of the shareholders' wealth. Okay? How can the shareholders watch if, by definition, a corporate veil blocks the owners from management? How can they? By law, they're not allowed to. So there is one of those again. There are these special relationships out there where the principal, by virtue of some permanent defect, cannot monitor and enforce. We call these kinds of relationships fiduciary. Fiduciary relationships. Your duties in these relationships as an agent are fiduciary duties. Black's Law Dictionary says fiduciary duty is the highest duty implied by law. The highest duty implied by law. Now that carries a wallop, not just because of that word highest, but because of the word implied. Legislators are all the time declaring, this is a fiduciary duty. But beyond that, they are not what makes it a fiduciary relationship. They can piss on themselves, they can write statutory law, they can put prison terms on, they can put paperwork in front of us as fiduciary agents, but they cannot change the fact that it is implied by law. It is common law. It is ancient law. It goes beyond any orders from some politician trying to score brownie points with a bunch of burned shareholders. It's implied by law. Now, the three characteristics of fiduciary duty are trust, loyalty, and fidelity, faithfulness. Fidelity is faithfulness. Trust, loyalty, and fidelity. If you are in a fiduciary relationship and you are the agent, you are not going to be monitored and enforced, and your performance is not monitored and enforced. You have to have a completely different perspective in this relationship. Let me tell you how hard this is, though. You're speaking as a parent. You see, as a parent, I'm an agent of my children, and I'm supposed to provide for them, give them a healthy, nurturing environment. I have to do all of the things that will make them the best possible citizens of the world. Imagine yourself in the years to come You're dragging home. You've had an absolutely exhausting day. You're beaten into the ground. You stagger into the house. Now you flop down. Well, the first thing you do, you're supposed to provide them with a nutritious meal, having all the food categories, delicious, and it's going to build strong bones and strong bodies. Well, you know what? Nuke and puke works pretty well. You know, put it in the microwave. There's your goddamn dinner right there. And if that's not enough, you can grab some snarf and barf on the way home and give it to them. Here, eat this. You flop down in your chair. You're tired. You're worn out. There they are, bouncing up and down on the couch. Now, you know what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to run up to them and hug them. Come on, honey. Let's get down. You're going to hurt yourself. Let's go play. We'll learn how. You know what you're going to do instead? You're going to sit there in your chair. You, get off that couch. Here, take my belt. Beat yourself on the ass. Stand in the corner. You're bad. That's what you're going to do. Fiduciary duty is not easy, but it's necessary. And to the extent that we do not explain this to people in stark terms, that there are relationships in this world where you should not anticipate that there's going to be a fist of a principle that will persistently and properly monitor and enforce your performance. There are going to be a few relationships like that in your life. Marriage is going to be one of them. The marriage contract can't monitor and enforce. It's just a thing. It's a legal construct. It will be up to the man and the woman to maximize the welfare of that principle, the marriage. The soldier, the Constitution cannot do a damn thing to that soldier. The soldier's job will be his own, to understand fully the consequences of his actions as a soldier. And that includes dying for his country if necessary. It's always better to make sure your enemy dies for his first. And all those great things. But at the same time, there's a problem here. Fiduciary relationships are, and I will tell you this right away, they are a bitch. You get into a company, and you rise to a certain level. Now, they're going to tell you, I shouldn't say that they are, but a lot of companies try to tell you, your relationship is fiduciary. Don't buy that. There's a level you get to. You'll know it when you get there, when it is fiduciary, when there is no longer monitoring and enforcement, and you as the agent have to stop being a normal person, and you have to rise above your own incentives to maximize self-interest. You'll know when it gets there. Here's the problem, though, is when you have more than one fiduciary relationship happening at the same time. If you are a fiduciary agent, that calls for everything you've got. That really does. It's going to be rare in your life, but there will be times. Marriage will be one of those. Corporate executive status will be another of those. Parenting will be another of those. You're going to find out something really, really difficult. They are going to all have the highest duty. You cannot prioritize. Remember what I said about Black's Law Dictionary? Fiduciary duty is the highest duty. There is no grade of the highest. If you are in two fiduciary relationships, each of them severally has highest status. And I speak from experience that when you have more than one of them, you can find out something really, really bad. You cannot do them both. Don't let yourself get into that situation. The children in the marriage, and then being responsible to your shareholders. Well, I tried to play them both, and I played them both. And at the end of the day, my businesses collapsed, and one day I went home, and my marriage was gone, and it was a really quiet house. Gee, I didn't have any more responsibilities. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.